In America, having a mental illness has become a crime. Jails in New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago are the three largest providers of mental health care in America. Across the country, as many as half of all incarcerated people have one or more psychiatric disorders. One in four fatal police shootings involves a person suffering from mental illness. And while in recent years the overall populations of prisons and jails has declined slightly, the number of prisoners with mental illness continues to rise nationwide. Journalist Elisa Roth looks at all of this in her new book, Insane, America's Criminal Treatment of Mental Illness, where she goes deep inside America's prisons and jails to reveal how tough-on-crime policies have helped transform them into warehouses for people with mental illness. Again, the name of the book is Insane, America's Criminal Treatment of Mental Illness, and we welcome Elisa Roth to the program this morning. Elisa, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
When it comes to this system that we have of our country's treatment of mental illness, what do you think is important for us to know of where our baseline is right now?
We simply don't have enough mental health care in this country, and access to mental health care, particularly for people without insurance or with Medicaid, is very, very difficult. There are too few clinics, the waits are long, there aren't enough psychiatrists, not enough psychologists, and this is exacerbated the further you get out of the metropolitan areas. So when you get into more rural areas, it's even more of a problem.
When it comes then to what you've looked at in this book of the criminal treatment of mental illness, what drew you to that aspect of mental health, the mental health system in our country?
I really came at it from the other side. I was looking at the criminal justice system and realizing that while we talk a lot about the role of race in the criminal justice system, we're starting to talk more about the role of poverty in the criminal justice system. There's this third piece of it, which is mental illness. And it, of course, overlaps with those two, but we don't talk about it nearly enough as one of the things that we see over and over again in jails and prisons and courts and in dealing with police and so on.
So when someone comes into the system, how do they usually come at it? You believe they come at it more through a crime than they do through, let's say, a doctor saying of someone who has been given the diagnosis of a mental illness?
We see it from both sides, and I think we often draw a false distinction between mental health care in the outside civilian world and mental health care inside the criminal justice world, so in jails and prisons. There are a lot of people who are patients in both of those places and often jump back between those two worlds. So one of the people that I followed for my book really has spent his entire life shuttling between those two places. We do see people who come into jails and prisons and get their first diagnosis in a correctional facility, but we also see people who have longstanding diagnoses in the outside world who then end up on the other side of that wall, so to speak.
You make the point in the book that the three largest providers of psychiatric care in this country are jails, not hospitals or clinics, but jails. Rikers Island, L.A. County Jail, and Cook County Jail in Chicago. That extrapolates across the country pretty much?
It absolutely extrapolates across the country. So they're the biggest because those are the biggest jails. But it's true in Rochester, it's true in Albany, it's true in Dubuque, you name it. The jails are among the largest providers of psychiatric care.
How does that come to be? In the sense that, as you also write, people with mental illness are more likely than others to get arrested. So is that why? And once they're in that system, they stay in that system?
That's certainly part of it. a person with mental illness has something like a 1 in 2 chance of getting arrested over the course of his or her lifetime. We also need to think about this as part of the story of mass incarceration. So we in this country lock up a tremendous number of people, and in doing so are collecting large numbers of people with mental illness. Again, in part because of the reasons that we lock people up. So if you look at people with mental illness in the criminal justice system, a very large percentage of them have a co-occurring substance use disorder. So they're using drugs in some way. If we're locking up large numbers of people for possessing drugs, dealing drugs, selling drugs, buying drugs, you name it, it stands to reason that many of those people are also going to have a mental illness.
And these are people, once they are in jail, they're less likely to make bail, as you say. They're more likely to get a longer sentence, and they're more likely to end up in solitary confinement. You write that they're also less likely to make parole. Is that because of the repetition of an action caused by the mental illness that perpetuates that?
In some cases, it's that. So people with mental illness often have a hard time following the rules in jail and prison and doing the kinds of things like taking courses or just having a job or all these sorts of requirements that make a parole board more likely to let them out on parole. But there's also a stigma to having mental illness. There's a fear around mental illness that pervades the entire system. And so I heard over and over again from judges in particular, but also from attorneys who said, you don't want to open the newspaper and have that person that you let out on the front page of the paper for having done something. So people are reluctant to let people with mental illness out, whether on parole or on bail or what have you, out of a fear that something is going to happen.
So as we spoke about a moment ago, the three largest providers of psychiatric care in this country are jails. What constitutes psychiatric care in a prison?
In many cases, not much. As we saw in the asylums and psychiatric hospitals of the mid-20th century, the ones like what we saw in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, there's a big reliance on medication. There's very little in the way of one-on-one therapy or group therapy or even therapeutic activities. In some cases, it's worse than that. So I describe in the book the conditions in Alabama where one prisoner described a clinician who would come by once every 2 months or so and bang on the door and say, hey, how are you doing, through the cell door. And that constituted the mental health check. There are places that are really looking to do better and making an effort, whether it's building a special behavioral health unit like we're seeing here in New York City at Rikers that mimics the behavioral health clinics that you see in the outside world with an emphasis on therapy and therapeutic activities and so on, or what we see in the state of Washington where the Department of Corrections has really made an effort to identify people with mental illness and particularly people with mental illness who are struggling and need more attention and more treatment.
Let us focus for a moment on solitary confinement, because you write that people with mental illness are often punished with solitary confinement. How does this exacerbate the symptoms in people who already have a mental illness or even previously healthy people that could cause a mental illness?
Let's start by talking about what solitary confinement really looks like. solitary confinement goes by a whole host of names, but what it amounts to is being locked for 23 hours a day, sometimes longer, 7 days a week, in a cell the size of, let's say, a bathroom. So a man standing in the middle of a typical solitary confinement cell can reach his arms out in either direction and touch walls on both sides. Often there is no window, or the window is so small and so grated that the daylight doesn't even come through. It can be very noisy, and you are really completely isolated from the world around you. So you're not talking to other prisoners. The only contact you have with other people is really with the officers who are delivering food or letting you in and out of the cell. And so it's a really a sensory deprivation environment of the worst order. And on top of that, people who are put into solitary will often lose privileges like television, like even reading materials. Often they'll lose the right to make phone calls or to, in some cases, to receive letters. So we've known for centuries that this kind of both sensory deprivation, but more importantly, a deprivation of human contact really has terribly detrimental effects on people's psyches. And so for somebody who already has a shaky grasp on reality, it's just that much more difficult to sustain. But even people who are absolutely sane when they go in will often come out showing symptoms of mental illness.
Elisa Roth is the author of the book Insane: America's Criminal Treatment of Mental Illness. We often look to the closing of state psychiatric hospitals as a problem and causing many issues within the mental health world. You make the point, however, though, that that alone did not cause this crisis.
Certainly, the lack of mental health care in this country has contributed to this crisis. But what I think we often fail to realize is that even at the height of institutionalization, so say 1955, there were many people with mental illness who were not living in institutions, who were receiving care elsewhere, or who weren't receiving care, but they were not getting care in an institution. This is really, to me, part of the story of mass incarceration. So on the one hand, we have the lack of mental health care, but on the other hand, we simply are locking up so many people that we are catching this very vulnerable population in that roundup.
So in how then are they caught into the system? What is catching them and bringing them into the system in the first place?
It's an interesting question because, of course, not all people with mental illness end up in the criminal justice system, and not all people in the criminal justice system have a mental illness. There's a large quantity of people who are picked up on what we could call quality of life crimes. As you know, there's a big overlap between the homeless population and people with mental illness. So there are a lot of people who are homeless who have a mental illness. And people often get arrested for things like sleeping on the sidewalk or public urination or just disorderly conduct. Somebody who has a severe mental illness and is very symptomatic might be standing on the street corner yelling, and that's somebody calls the cops and he gets arrested. In some cases, the police officer may even realize that the person has a mental illness, but there's simply no place else other than jail for the officer to take this person. In other cases, it's a little bit more complicated. So if police are going after people who use drugs or deal drugs or sell drugs. They may be picking up people who have both a substance use disorder and a mental illness. And then there are people who are committing crimes that are a direct result of the mental illness. These are far fewer than I think we, the media, tend to make people think, but somebody who's hearing voices that then tell them to do something, to attack somebody or to hurt themselves or what have you, that then get caught in the system.
You point to a few things, but the slowness of the system, what slows it down? What grinds it to a halt?
The system is already slow. Even if you're a straightforward case without mental illness, without extenuating circumstances, the court system, particularly in big cities, tends to move very slowly. So if we start with a very slow baseline, and then we bring in somebody who has a mental illness, everything takes longer. I think that one of the key pieces that we don't hear about nearly enough is the question of competency to stand trial. So we, as a country, have always said that we will not put somebody before a judge who isn't sane enough to understand what's going on. So to understand the charges that are being brought, to understand just what's going on in the courtroom, who all the players are, and this is a critical piece of it, sane enough to help your attorney provide meaningful defense on your behalf. And what if a person is thought to have a mental illness, if his attorney, say, suspects that this person has a mental illness, he or she will refer the defendant for an examination to decide, is this person sane enough to do all those things? There is often, in part because there is such a backup in the mental health care system, it can be a very long wait before that person is even examined and determined to be sane or not. If the defendant is found insane, then there's a second delay because the case will be stopped and the person will be sent for treatment to be restored to competency, in other words, to be made sane enough to go before a judge and do all the things that need to be done to keep the case moving. So there's often a delay in getting into the facility that will provide that treatment. And then, of course, the competency isn't restored overnight. It takes, on average, 6 months to restore somebody to competency, but it may be longer than that. And during that time, the case is just stopped completely. The third piece of this is that because the system moves so slowly, the criminal justice system, the court system, what happens not infrequently is that a person is found incompetent to stand trial, he's referred for treatment, is restored to competency, sent back to jail, and is sitting in jail for so long waiting for the trial to proceed or for the case to proceed that he will then become incompetent again and the whole process has to start over again. And so that can really drag things out even for years.
So let us talk about programs that you see. Are there programs that you see that are a bright light, that are a way of changing what we're seeing and moving us in a direction to solve many of the problems that you've outlined over the last several moments?
The tricky part about bringing reform to both mental health care and criminal justice is that, as you know, although we talk about them as monolithic entities, they're really patchworks of small systems. So what's happening here in New York City is very different from what's happening upstate, and what's happening in Albany is not the same thing that's happening in Rochester. But the positive in this is that we are seeing a lot of local efforts that are starting to change things. Training police officers to respond better to people with mental illness is one that we're seeing in a lot of places, and understanding that police officers are often the first responders to a mental health crisis. So how does a police officer deal with that? What's the appropriate way to respond to somebody who's having a crisis and may or may not have committed a crime, or the crime is a result of that crisis? The second piece follows from that, which is that it's all well and good to respond in a different way, to take a more therapeutic, friendly approach to dealing with the situation. But if you don't have an easy way to get that person into some kind of a treatment situation, the officers often end up taking them to jail because it's the faster, cheaper option. So we are seeing places start to develop crisis centers. San Antonio has really led the way on this, that let officers bring a person in crisis to a health facility, hand them off very quickly, and then the facility is able to stabilize the person and then get them into treatment in the community. The third piece of this is diverting people out of the court system altogether. So an acknowledgement that somebody who really has a mental illness, whose behavior is driven because of that mental illness, needs to be not in jail or in prison, but in some kind of treatment. So that often means outpatient treatment in the community, but it requires somebody to say, you don't belong here, meaning jail, and you belong over there, and then connecting them to those services and making sure that they stay in those services. So Miami has really led the way on the diversion, and we're seeing more and more cities looking to places like San Antonio and Miami to reconsider how they approach this problem.
The name of the book is Insane, America's Criminal Treatment of Mental Illness. It is published by Basic Books. Lisa Roth, thank you very much for spending time with us this morning. I do appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
A great pleasure. Thank you. Again, the name of the book is Insane, America's Criminal Treatment of Mental Illness. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.